Hi, this is the American Psychological Association's Division 15 podcast series on emerging research in educational psychology. My name is Jeff Green. Thanks for joining us. There's a big difference between intention and impact. I'm one of those professors who provides like hundreds of comments and track changes all over a student's draft document. And I really hope those comments are received the way I intend them, as helpful and encouraging. But when the student opens the document and sees hundreds of comments, if the impact on them is negative, then I just haven't done a good job of providing feedback. Now, sometimes people actually fear giving critical feedback to others. And in some cases, that fear is due to racial anxiety, such as when a white teacher fears that critiquing a black student's work will suggest the teacher is being prejudiced. So instead of risking being perceived in a way they do not want, the teacher provides more compliments and less critical feedback than is warranted. This is an example of positive feedback bias, and it's troubling for lots of reasons, particularly because it deprives the black student of important feedback that could help them learn and grow. But what exactly is positive feedback bias, and what should we do about it? Well, Dr. Kent Harbor has been studying this positive feedback bias for 25 years, and he just published a new model of how and why it occurs and how to address it. I'm really excited to talk to him about that model and his work today. Dr. Kent Harbor is a professor of psychology at Rutgers University at Newark. He received his doctorate in experimental social psychology from Stanford University in 1995, completed postdoctoral training in health behavior at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and worked for 2 years as a research scientist addressing educational policy and practices at American Institutes for Research in Palo Alto, California. His research program has two main directions. One focuses on interracial feedback, especially the positive bias in feedback from white instructors to students of color. The other examines how psychosocial resources, like social support or self-esteem, affect how people perceive the physical world and the social world. His research has been supported by federal and private foundations and has been featured in The Atlantic, Newsweek, Huffington Post, and other popular venues. Today, we're talking about Kent's 2023 article in Educational Psychologist entitled "The Model of Threat-Infused Intergroup Feedback: Why, When, and How Feedback to Ethnic Minority Learners is Positively Biased." This article is part of a special issue on the psychological perspectives on the effects and effectiveness of assessment feedback. Kent, thanks so much for contributing this article and talking to me about it today.
Oh, Jeff, very glad to be here. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction.
Of course. So can you tell us what positive feedback bias is and how you got interested in it?
Sure. So, Jeff, you gave a really good summary of basically what a positive bias is, which is the tendency among some white instructors to provide more praise, less criticism to students of color, certain disadvantaged minorities, than they give to white students for work of equal merit. Mm-hmm. So that's it in brief. In the studies that I've done, subjects will get an identically poorly written essay. They're asked to critique it. And beforehand, they're subtly informed that the writer is either, in some cases, African-American, sometimes African-American and Latino, Latina, or white. The essay is exactly the same. It's always written in a very sort of a C-minus level. But what the basic finding is that the feedback given by the white instructor, who could be an undergraduate in some cases, could be a teacher trainee, can be actual teacher, is more positive when the instructor believes that the recipient is a minority rather than white. So that's a very basic storyline on it. How I got into it, in part, my graduate advisor, Claude Steele, had a very active lab looking at stereotype threat,
right,
which is the vulnerability that some ethnic minority people have around evaluation, where in some cases, it's not clear whether or not a criticism they're receiving is a reflection of the true merit of their work, or it has to do with the animosity or the prejudices of the person who's evaluating them. And it's that uncertainty that can disturb their performance. At the very least, it can distract them. And you know, rather than focusing on the task at hand, they're sort of wondering, what is the social dynamic that's occurring now?
Right.
That whole sort of domain that Claude was developing then got me thinking, well, there might be also ambiguities and uncertainties that white instructors have when they are in the role of providing feedback and evaluation to minority learners. So that's some of the background from which this research emerged.
Yeah, fascinating. So it makes a lot of sense to me that you're working with Claude Steele and you're kind of looking at another perspective on this dynamic that happens between, in this case, you know, white educators and then students of color. So really fascinating perspective. I guess, you know, there might be some people who would wonder, well, I mean, is positive bias really a bad thing? So why are we concerned about positive bias in this case?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it has to do with the value of feedback itself. Mm-hmm. So in the educational psychology literature, feedback has been sort of identified as probably the strongest educational tool and asset for learning. Mm-hmm. And it is so because it does so many things at one time. So you can almost break it up into two broad clusters. One are the cognitive benefits of getting good feedback. Mm-hmm. It helps you understand what the task is about. Helps you know what expectations are placed on you. How do you track your success? How do you internalize standards of doing a good job or a bad job? Mm-hmm. And probably even most important, good feedback teaches people how to learn, and they become self-sufficient learners. Mm-hmm. They can sort of incorporate those own standards themselves. So those are sort of the cognitive mental benefits. There's also motivational benefits. So when you get good feedback and you have an idea from it, what things you can do to work better or what things you need to address, it gives you a greater sense of control over your own work. Mm-hmm. That increases your self-efficacy, you feel more autonomy, and all those things together increase the intrinsic motivation to learn. Mm-hmm. So it provides both cognitive benefits, it provides motivational benefits. But the critical sort of condition for feedback is that you have to trust it.
Right.
You have to trust that you're getting it in good faith, that the person who's supplying you. But when you think about it, the relationship between a learner and an instructor is a very intimate one. It's really one in which you, as a learner, place a considerable amount of vulnerability and have to place trust in the instructor. Does this person know what they're talking about? But more important, are they really motivated to help me?
Right.
And are they seeing who I am? Do they understand my concerns? You know, if I seem to be grimacing, do they see that as that I'm struggling to understand, or they see me as angry? Do they understand who I am? Mm-hmm. And so if that trust is compromised, mm-hmm. you're not sure whether or not this person is really with you or not, for you or not, then that information that is being delivered is itself compromised. Mm-hmm. Can I trust, in the negative sense, this criticism? Mm-hmm. But also, and this is where it becomes really fascinating, this work that Jennifer Crocker and Brenda Major and others have done, you can also be vulnerable when you think that the praise you're getting is compromised.
Right.
And in fact, what Jennifer Crocker did in this classic study in the early 90s is that it could be more demoralizing for a minority student, a minority learner, to get suspect praise than suspect criticism. Mm-hmm. She did this study where African-American and white learners were getting praise from a white instructor, either in conditions where they were invisible from the instructor. Mm. And so there was no concern that their ethnicity had any influence on the feedback they were receiving. Mm-hmm. When they got praise, if the student was African-American or white, it didn't matter. Their self-esteem was elevated from the praise. Mm-hmm. When they were no longer anonymous, when they could be seen and their ethnicity was visible, for a white student, praise again boosted their self-esteem. For a black recipient of feedback, not only did their self-esteem not go up, it was depressed when they got praise.
Mm, wow.
And what Crocker and her associates inferred is that, in this case, the African-American student was wondering, is this praise about what I did, or is it about my ethnic identity? Is this really about me? Mm-hmm. And in an odd way, if the response is to their ethnicity and not to their actual performance, they become invisible.
Right.
So those are the kinds of issues that then can compromise feedback. And that can then cause students to disidentify from learning. So that's why this positive feedback bias could have important implications.
That's a great explanation, and it makes a lot of sense. So we want to try to understand how, when, and why positive feedback bias happens. And so you actually created this model of threat-infused intergroup feedback, or MOTIF. I like that acronym. That's a good one. Where you argue that racial anxiety drives the positive feedback bias. So can you talk to us a little bit about what racial anxiety is in this case, and then how it can lead to this bias?
Sure. Racial anxiety is the concern that white people have that they'll be seen by others, and the case that I'm going to make is seen by themselves, as behaving in ways that appear racially prejudicial. Mm-hmm. And since the mid-20th century on, racial prejudice, bigotry have emerged as serious threats to a person's social standing and to how they see themselves.
Right.
So much so that in studies where white people have interactions with a racial minority, and there's some sense they might have that they can fail in their self-presentation mm-hmm. as a good egalitarian person, mm-hmm. they show classic stress reactions. Mm-hmm. They have cardiovascular stress reactions. They have hormonal reactions. And what's very interesting is that the more they show this kind of distress, the more positive they respond to the minority person with whom they're interacting, mm-hmm. and the more positive they rate their interactions. So they're more likely to say that was a great interaction, though their body is showing that that was actually very distressing.
Okay.
So the motif models use this idea of racial anxiety to say that if white people are in general concerned in an interaction, in a communication with a ethnic minority person, the stakes are going to be a lot higher when they're giving feedback, mm-hmm. especially critical feedback.
Right.
Because at this point, what does it mean to be criticizing the performance of a person of another ethnic group? That's exactly where a person who is bigoted might display their bigotry.
Right.
And so going back to my earlier description about sort of the benefits of receiving feedback, for the person who's giving feedback, for instructor, they know that part of their goal is informational. Part of their job, as you were sort of describing yourself, Jeff, about when you're giving feedback to your students, mm-hmm. you want to be clear, you want to be candid, you want to assert the expertise that you have as an instructor so that your learners can benefit in terms of their work, in terms of their learning. But you also want to be careful that you're not doing this without sensitivity to their motives, to their needs, to their personhood.
Right.
And you want to maintain a rapport. You want to be polite. And so there's a balance between being informative and being sensitive. Mm-hmm. And this is for feedback, irrespective or independent of the issues of interracial dynamics. This challenge of getting that balance right is one that instructors frequently deal with. Mm-hmm. And often resolve by defaulting towards being more positive. Mm-hmm. Well, if they do that when race is not an issue, when racial anxiety is present, and they're worrying, will my criticisms go beyond the other kinds of liabilities, but can also add a communication of prejudice or bigotry, mm-hmm. then a threat is aroused,
right.
and that leads to the positive bias.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think might be going on is that when we're doing feedback right as instructors, our focus is on what does this person, this learner, need? And our camera is sort of focused on the learner. Where are they struggling? Where do they have strengths? What do they need from me right now? Mm-hmm. To what degree do they need a supportive statement? To what degree do I need to be really clear about where they need to work more? It's about them.
Right.
But when this racial anxiety is induced, the camera turns inward. What do I do to protect me? Mm-hmm. And at that point, the learner, in a sense, can become the instrument through which you can reconfirm as an instructor, as a white instructor, your own moral goodness or your own social standing. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the positive bias can emerge, and that's where some of the liabilities can arise.
Yeah, that makes sense. The more anxiety you're feeling, you're having the stress response, and the white teacher might then, in turn, feel this need to be overly positive to ensure that they're not being perceived as prejudiced. That makes sense to me. And your model talks about some moderators of that relationship that can either amplify the likelihood of this bias or decrease it. You have three of them. Let's start with this risk of appearing prejudiced. So how does that affect the kind of racial anxiety that someone might be feeling?
Fair enough. I'm glad you mentioned that. So there's actually three moderators. One is mm-hmm. the risk of appearing prejudiced. The other is being motivated to avoid that risk.
Right.
And then the third is having these resources, which are called anxiety buffers, which will reduce the anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So the impact of racial anxiety is kind of the combination of those three major moderators. So back to your question about the first one, the risk of appearing prejudiced.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So some of this has been tested, but it's relatively straightforward, that the risk will be greater when the feedback recipient is someone who is subject to negative stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And the domain in which you're giving feedback relates to those stereotypes. Mm-hmm. The third element is that the kind of criticisms that you're giving are difficult to validate. Mm-hmm. And I can give an example of what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. And this is really where my very first feedback study gave me a clue that this racial anxiety might be the underlying driver. So in that study, as I think I mentioned before, the feedback recipient, these were undergrads at that time, were given a poorly written essay. And this was an essay that was just, I mean, it was a mess. It had grammar problems, it had spelling, punctuation, mm-hmm. but it also had some content-related problems. Its cogency, its persuasiveness, its logic.
Right.
The subjects believe this essay was written by another student at the university who's in a writing program. Actually, I wrote it. And I don't mean to brag, but I seem to have a gift of writing really bad second-year college essays. So they got one of these disasters. Then they gave actual copy edits on it. So we looked at the real behavior, and they engaged really deeply. It seems to get covered with spelling corrections and marginal comments. And we then coded how many of these were positive, how many of these were negative. But we also looked at to what degree were the topics having to do with what we call mechanics. Mm-hmm. Spelling, grammar, punctuation, or content, persuasiveness, logic, coherence. And we found that there was no positive bias at all for the mechanics. It was equally critical if the writer was, in this case, African-American or white. Mm-hmm. The bias only emerged for content.
Oh, okay.
And mm-hmm. what that suggested was that, you know, mechanics is socially safe to criticize.
Yep.
One is that you have external reference you can draw on. You know, the dictionary says this is how the word is spelled. You know, Strunk and White says this is the kind of grammar you should be using.
Right.
So you have objective backup. And the other part is that most people are not hugely offended when you tell them you should use a semicolon rather than a full colon. Hmm. That's not a huge moral, you know, personal wound. Content is the obverse. There are no or very few objective standards for when a particular phrase or sentence or idea is logical or persuasive. And the other is when you do address a person's, you know, the coherence of their thinking, the strength of their argumentation, you're really sort of talking about things that are much more consequential to them as a learner and as a person.
Mm-hmm.
So the stakes are higher. The stakes are higher, and you don't have a way of justifying as easily as you do with mechanics. Mm-hmm. So the risk is increased.
Right.
And that's where we got the positive bias. Hmm. And that indicated that there is something about the personal risk that drives the bias. And that helps sort of exclude some other explanations.
Yeah, that's very compelling, this idea that, you know, if a white educator, white participant in this case, thinks that they are grading a black student's paper and they're only commenting upon the objective pieces of it, whereas if they think it's a white student that wrote it, now they're commenting both on objective and subjective. I mean, that's pretty compelling evidence that there's some kind of anxiety, you know, some kind of image maintaining motive happening there.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And it seems like in your model, you're arguing also that the graders' motives to avoid appearing prejudiced can also drive this anxiety. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's been a number of studies from some other researchers that also looked at positive feedback bias or its variants. And some of them were looking at what are called internal motives to avoid appearing prejudice, and others are looking at external, sort of extrinsic ones. So the extrinsic would be, I don't want other people to see me as a prejudiced person. Mm-hmm. The internal one would be, I don't want to see myself that way. So that'd be sort of a public reputational concern.
Right.
And the findings were kind of mixed. Some of them showed that it seemed to be driven by external. Others seemed to show that it was driven by internal motives. So, for example, one study was looking at what they called the failure to warn. This is Crosby and Monin, a really interesting study, which was asking, are white instructors not providing minority students sort of a stop sign or a caution sign when these students are taking on more than they really should be taking on? When they're, say, taking on a course load, for example, which is more ambitious than might be appropriate. And they find that that does occur, that they're not giving these minority students the kind of warning they would give to a white student who had the same background, mm-hmm. same standing. And they found that this is driven in part by internal motives to not appear prejudiced.
Right.
Some other research by Croft and Schmader. In this case, they were looking at feedback to Aboriginal Canadians compared to white Canadians. Mm-hmm. And they found that there was, in this case, a hesitancy to provide critical feedback. And that, in this case, was, and they found it was driven by these external motives. So the story seemed to be mixed. I became more and more convinced that what was the driver for the positive feedback bias, more than the external, was the internal, mm-hmm. was the desire to see oneself as morally good
right.
and not as prejudiced. And so I can kind of give sort of the sequence of studies that led me there. Would that be helpful?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, as I mentioned before, the first of these was finding that the bias was stronger for the subjective area of content than mechanics. Then a next study looked at what happens when you're giving feedback face-to-face rather than through a correspondence. Mm-hmm. And in this study, our subjects were given, again, the poorly written essay, and they were told that there's a person in the waiting area who was either African-American or white, was the writer, and that their job now, after they had graded the essay, was to directly report to this person a summary of their feedback. Hmm. Well, this person, of course, was a Confederate of the study.
Right.
And we had either, three black Confederates and three white Confederates. And they were trained to have a vocabulary of basically five utterances. Uh-huh, okay, yeah, I see. Hmm. Turns out, if you have those five utterances, you can maintain a conversation almost indefinitely. Huh. But they did it in one of two demeanors. There was the friendly demeanor. Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Yeah, I see. And then there was the cool demeanor. Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I see. And the question was, would demeanor and race interact? And we expected that if the feedback recipient was white, the demeanor would not affect feedback. The unfriendly response would be interpreted as this person is not able to appropriately, receive the feedback that is given in earnest. It's about them. But when the feedback recipient was African-American, that tone of being cool and sort of reserved, basically being unfriendly, might signal that you as the feedback supplier just crossed a line, that you might have betrayed a prejudice. You might be seen that way. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then your motive would be to correct your self-image rather than to just proceed in giving more critical feedback. And that's what we found, that there was positive feedback only to the African-American recipient who was unfriendly. An African-American recipient who was friendly got feedback that was no different than feedback that was given to a friendly or an unfriendly white recipient for whom there was no difference. Mm-hmm. So that gives another clue that there's something motivational going on here.
Right.
Another study where we looked at the kind of language that was being communicated in open-ended responses. So in this case, we wanted to see not only the content of what was being communicated, good essay, bad essay would be the content, would be the manifest content, but the manner, the tone in which that feedback was supplied. Mm-hmm. And there's this very good work by a communications scholar named Howie Giles, who looks at what he calls over-accommodation. And he says that the kind of language that people often use and the tone in which they communicate it can be overly accommodating, overly almost kind of saccharine, when they're communicating with a person who they regard as either lower status or vulnerable. And that kind of language they use is more laced with warmth, contains more praise. So all the things that might actually affect the kind of communication that goes from a white instructor to a person of color. And we found that that was true, mm-hmm. that the feedback to open-ended questions that a white instructor gave, and these were, again, undergraduates, to either a white learner or a black learner, that there was more praise given to the black than to the white learner, but the phrasing was simpler. They used simpler words. Mm. It's a simpler diction. They used fewer sort of causal and complex clauses in how they communicated. Mm-hmm. So you're given an over-communication that you're doing well, but the implicit message in the diction was that you're almost being patronized.
Yeah, right.
But what seemed to drive that was the degree to which our subjects, the instructors, felt comfortable or uncomfortable giving feedback. Mm-hmm. They showed that tendency of over-accommodation only when they're uncomfortable, but only when they're uncomfortable giving feedback to a black recipient. Discomfort did not produce that over-accommodation to a white. Mm-hmm. So we got, again, more clues that there's some kind of discomfort that is driving the positive feedback. But we didn't know for certain if it really had to do with this racial anxiety. We didn't know for certain if it was coming from a self-image threat. Mm-hmm. So we addressed that in a study where we tried to specifically target that issue of, are white instructors worried about how they appear to themselves?
Right.
And so the way that we did that study, this is with teacher trainees, we used the basic feedback paradigm. You'll be giving feedback to a student here on the campus, and then you're subtly informed that the writer is either African-American or white. But before you actually get the essay, before you start the feedback, the experimenter looks a little bit confused, says, oh, goodness, I forgot. There's another research team. They asked as a favor, would subjects in the study like you complete this social issue survey that they're developing? It's totally anonymous. It's got nothing to do with our experiment, but we got to get it done. So would you mind doing it? And they all say yes. There are three versions of the social issue survey, and they're different in terms of trying to induce or not induce a feeling of self-image threat. The one that induces threat asks questions such as, should it be legal for private businesses to stay open on Martin Luther King Day? Or another one, should people be allowed to keep the Confederate flag in their own homes? Hmm. Well, you know, our sort of First Amendment laws, and we don't require businesses to shut down. If someone has some bizarre need to have that Confederate flag, it's legal. It's not necessarily we would condone, but it's not illegal. Mm-hmm. And so our subjects are forced to repeatedly endorse items like this. And they see from their own behavior, I'm responding like someone who seems to be unsympathetic to minorities. Mm-hmm. In the self-image boost condition, they're given a parallel set of questions. Should government offices be closed on Martin Luther King Day? To which they can comfortably say yes. Mm-hmm. Should the Confederate flag not fly over government buildings? Yes, I don't think it should. Mm-hmm. And so they can see from their own behavior that they have repeatedly endorsed and demonstrated an egalitarian sensitivity. Mm-hmm. And then a control condition, you know, they're asked about the supermarket. Okay, so nothing totally irrelevant to race. And then they actually give feedback to either an African-American or a white on one of these poorly written essays. And what we get is there is that positive bias, but only among those who are threatened. Mm-hmm. Those whose self-image was affirmed, they could demonstrate their egalitarian bona fides. Their feedback to a black writer was indistinguishable from the feedback that a white writer got.
Right.
So it seemed like we could turn on the bias by making people feel threatened about their self-image, and we could turn it off by reassuring them mm-hmm. and removing the threat.
You know, that's a very clever design, and it's a great way to kind of intervene to understand, right? You kind of change something and you investigate whether or not that change leads to the effect that you hypothesized. And in this mm-hmm. case, you do seem to be implicating kind of that racial anxiety and that internal, right, that internal sense of how the person thinks about themselves. So that's a really nice example of the kind of research that you've done. And I'm wondering about your third moderator, anxiety buffers, and how mm-hmm. that might be leveraged to decrease the likelihood of this positive feedback bias, which we don't want.
Sure. So as you might have mentioned in the opening, another area of research I've been interested in is the role of psychosocial resources mm-hmm. and how people cope with stressors. And so resources are things like social support is a resource, feeling good about yourself is a resource, having a sense of purpose is a resource. Mm-hmm. And what we found in a study that we did with actual teachers, the 2012 study, we want to see whether, in one part, it says, do actual public school teachers, K-12 teachers, show the positive bias. We're getting it with undergraduates, we're getting it with teacher trainees. But if this was to have some social relevance, it'd be important to see whether that occurs with actual teachers. Mm-hmm. We found that it did. Mm. But we also found that the degree to which, in this case, teachers were giving feedback they thought to either an African-American or a Latino or a white. And we found that there really overall was no positive feedback bias to African-Americans, except when we looked at the role of school-based social support. This is the degree to which teachers felt they were being supported by other teachers or by the administrators.
Okay.
Teachers who felt that they had sufficient social support from school did not show the positive bias to African-Americans. Hmm. But those who were lacking in social support, who felt unsupported, did show the positive bias. So social support is a classic anxiety buffer. These teachers lacking social support didn't have access to that buffer. And therefore, you know, if racial anxiety is driving the bias, they didn't have any way of mitigating it. Now, they didn't have that particular way to mitigate it. And then they were more likely to show the positive bias. Interestingly, there was a direct main effect positive bias to Latinos. It was unmoderated by social support, suggesting that there might be different drivers for the positive bias towards African Americans than to other groups. So that was one indication of the role of anxiety buffers. The other was the study I just mentioned, that when people's sense of self-worth or their self-image is boosted, they don't show the positive bias. Mm-hmm. A study that we've just completed, this is with Jamie Gorman and Rachel Godsell here at Rutgers. Mm-hmm. We wanted to see whether or not wise feedback framing might be a buffer. Mm-hmm. And wise feedback is a paradigm that was developed by Jeff Cohn and by David Yeager, not looking at those who are supplying feedback, but minority students who are receiving it. And their logic is really, I think, lovely, that what makes receiving feedback often is that ambiguity. What is this person telling me about their criticism? Can I trust it? And if I feel it might be coming in bad faith, I'm going to reject it. And so how do you convey feedback in a way that makes it palatable, that allows it to be metabolized? Mm-hmm. And what they found is that if the feedback is framed with just a very brief note that communicated two messages, one is expect critical feedback because I do that for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's who I am. Critical feedback is the norm. And the other part is that feedback is an affirmation. I give critical feedback when I believe people have the abilities to benefit. So this makes criticism, one, it's not targeting you. Everyone gets it. It's normal. And two, it can signify faith in your ability as a learner. Mm-hmm. And when minority students get feedback framed in that wise way, their performance shows these gains that last for years. It's a very striking effect from a very simple intervention. So our thinking was, okay, we can see how this wise feedback framing can make receiving feedback psychologically safe. As an instructor, it might also make delivering feedback psychologically safe. If I declare to a class at the beginning of the semester, hey, everybody, glad you're in this class. Good to see you all. I got to let you know I'm a bit of a tough grader. And I'm doing it because I think you all can rise to the challenge. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I can worry less about how my feedback is going to be interpreted by any particular person. I've already conveyed my feedback philosophy and my feedback style, and I've done it to everybody universally. Mm-hmm. So we did a study with actual teachers at in Michigan and California. They did the standard sort of feedback paradigm. You're going to be giving feedback to a student, you know, at your grade level. In fact, we had a whole website called Feedback Forward through which they conveyed their feedback. But before they gave feedback, we said, look, students often benefit by knowing, and which turns out to be true, what is the feedback philosophy of the person who's giving them feedback? And so the teachers were given one of three different feedback attitude surveys. One allowed them to endorse wise feedback. Statements like, I believe giving critical and candid feedback helps students learn. I believe that you show respect to students by giving them candid feedback. And the teachers believed that this survey was then going to be transmitted to their learner. So their learner would know what their feedback philosophy was. And the other condition, they were given questions that allowed them to emphasize being sensitive and warm. And then in a control condition, there were these banal questions. I can't remember exactly what they were, like, you know, how important it is to keep your chalk supply stocked up? You know, things that had nothing to do with evaluation. So what we found is that overall, teachers who were allowed to communicate an endorsement of these wise feedback principles gave more candid feedback, gave more critical feedback, mm-hmm. both in terms of these overall ratings and in terms of their open-ended comments. Mm. It didn't vary by the race of the writer. So the benefit of being able to endorse wise feedback was demonstrated in feedback to an African-American or a Latino or a white student. But we think that that's fine because it's the minority students who are most likely to experience a liability if they're getting less than candid feedback. Mm-hmm. So if this positive feedback framing allows for more candid universally, it might be especially valuable to minority students.
That makes a lot of sense, and I could see how it'd be really important to get that kind of positive feedback framing idea into teacher preparation programs, educator preparation programs, et cetera. And your article has a number of great suggestions for helping teachers kind of move past this. Your article also has some really wonderful directions for future research. So I'm just kind of curious, what are a couple that you think are really promising?
Thanks. Yeah. Well, I think one, probably the most important, the motif model identifies racial anxiety as the driver of the positive bias. The studies that I've described to you all suggest that that anxiety is the driver, but it's not been directly tested. Mm-hmm. Not in the ways that some other researchers have who have looked at interracial communications have shown. So, for example, getting some direct measure of stress, cardiovascular stress, hormonal stress, that white instructors display when they're giving feedback to minority students. So that direct link between racial anxiety and the positive feedback bias still needs to be demonstrated. Mm-hmm. Another issue is sort of what are the ways in which the positive feedback bias is perceived by students generally? What I mean by that is often teachers provide feedback in a class setting, and they'll give feedback to a particular student in front of the rest of the class. Do non-minority students recognize that positive feedback bias is occurring?
Right.
And does that affect their own interpretations of their classmates who are minority students?
Interesting.
Another issue has to do with, I mentioned a study where an African-American student who responded to feedback in a sort of called an unfriendly way was more likely to get the positive feedback bias. Well, that suggests there might be a social dilemma that minority learners experience in a feedback interaction. A lot of us, I mean, you know, Jeff, you and I, we have conversations with colleagues and with collaborators all the time about our work. And there's a back and forth. And someone will criticize something that we said or an approach we take, and we disagree with them.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrestle back and forth. And that wrestling is really valuable. We might ultimately agree with what they were saying. But it's important that we have the chance to say, I'm not sure I get it. Or what do you really mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of the fun of what we do.
Sure.
But if we were, in a sense, kind of handcuffed, if we were to challenge or show that we were uncertain about the feedback and that led to a positive bias, then our choices might become either we project an agreeableness and suppress or withhold our concerns or our confusions, in which case we can get candid feedback, but we can't engage in the conversation.
Right.
Or if we do try to have the conversation, we show that our confusion or our disagreement, then we don't get feedback we can trust.
Mm.
So that, I think, might be another area that, you know, that could be explored.
So for teachers who do want to maintain good relationships with students, but also give them critical feedback, how would you recommend they engage with students to communicate those messages?
So I think one of the reasons that this positive bias occurs is that teachers, like I think I mentioned earlier on, it really is important in feedback to establish rapport and trust with students.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part is that's really important to be clear and candid. And it's appropriate that teachers pursue both ends. What can happen is that they use any feedback communication as a single channel in which they try to convey both messages at once.
Mm-hmm.
And that can sometimes lead to some confusing statements. Like one of our studies, we found a concluding message from an instructor to a minority learner. I think your ideas are great. Just work on the logic, coherence, and persuasiveness, and it'll be fine.
Huh.
So they were trying to both be supportive and also convey feedback, and they got this weird garbled message.
Right.
One way to address it is just sequence those goals.
Mm-hmm.
At time one, establish rapport with the students. Ask them about their lives, about what they want to do in class, what kind of things, concerns they have. You know, there's this wonderful research on listening that just listening carefully engenders a lot of trust. Now that you've got that job done, now you can provide feedback which is candid and clear. So just the both goals are laudable. Both are necessary. Just separate them.
Is there anything that you would not recommend people do when trying to address the positive feedback bias?
Yes. And so this is sort of a caution I have, which I call sort of a solution to avoid, which is, you know, there might be a temptation to try to suppress sort of negative thoughts or, you know, the kind of anxiety that from which the bias is arising. But suppression just never works. It actually typically has a rebound effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'd probably be better to sort of acknowledge the anxiety than trying to shove it away or push it away. And then the other would be for sort of, you know, administrators or those who are working with teachers. I'd be careful not to try to target or locate a positive feedback prone teacher.
Mm.
I think having policies like that will just increase the anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's better to try to work on the environment in which teachers are working rather than trying to target particular teachers. Mm. That also could be an area that would be worth researching.
Yeah. And one of the great things about your article is this model and the studies that you've described all point to a number of just really fascinating directions for future research like you've outlined here. And so I really encourage our listeners to check out your article because you really go into more detail and describe different directions that seem really, really promising, particularly the one about kind of directly looking at that racial anxiety piece. You know, speaking of our listeners, many of them want to write an article for educational psychologists, but some of them aren't quite sure how, or they're not quite sure how to start. Do you have any advice for people who are trying to write for that journal?
Jeff, I got invited. Mm-hmm. And well, educational psychologist seems to want two things, which I really find laudable. They want research that has some real world implications, mm-hmm. but they want it to be theoretically grounded.
Right.
And I think they're willing to kind of, in a certain way, look at something that might be taking a bit of a risk if it opens up a new pathway, a new perspective.
Right.
Their standards are high for rigor, but you will get credit for being innovative or trying to be. And I think that's what makes it an interesting journal.
Well, that seems like a really great place to wrap it up for today. I encourage all of our listeners to check out Kent's article in Educational Psychologist entitled The Model of Threat-Infused Intergroup Feedback, Why, When, and How Feedback to Ethnic Minority Learners is Positively Biased. And that's part of a special issue on psychological perspectives on the effects and effectiveness of assessment feedback. Kent, again, thanks so much for your hard work on the article and for talking to me about it today.
Thank you, Jeff.
And finally, to you, our listener, I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I did. And if you did, I encourage you to check out the other episodes on your favorite podcast application or consider rating and reviewing us. You can also go to our APA Division 15 website, where all of our podcasts are linked in the publication section. Again, thank you for listening.